A lot of folks are also talking about the nuclear button. Is there a button? And of course, now we've all sort of taken a breath and said, wait, thank God there's no button for Kim Jong-un or Donald Trump, that it's a little more complicated than that. And I wanted to find a little bit about it. Oriana Pawlik joins us again. She's an air warfare reporter at military.com. And also on a phone line is Michael Allen, a professor of history at Northwestern University, both of them doing work on presidential powers and the way this thing actually works. Let me see if I can get both of you on at the same time. We'll start with Oriana. Are you there? This is John. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back. And Michael, are you there?
Yes. Thanks.
Thank you both for joining us. Oriana, is there a button, or why do we call it that? Everybody's worried about the instantaneous hitting of a button and suddenly nuclear weapons get launched, but there is nothing like that, right?
Correct. It's kind of more of a symbolic talk of what the button really is. It's just how quickly everyone does assemble and how the process trickles down through the chain of command. Depending on what the situation is, first the president would be briefed, and that initial information would come from Air Force Strategic Command, also known as STRATCOM. It would then go to the Secretary of Defense and then to the president, and the president would assemble his advisors as well as being on the phone with Strategic Command, and they would plan out the best way to launch a nuclear attack should it come down to that.
And I think most of us, Michael, when we think about this, imagine, okay, North Korea, China, Russia, somebody's launched missiles at us, so we have to hurry up and launch missiles at them before we're incapacitated. But we could do it preemptively. Is there anything, as you understand it, Michael, that would keep the president himself from launching the bombs first?
No, there's not. Not really. Theoretically, the Secretary of Defense or other high-ranking cabinet officials could attempt to countermand a presidential order, but doing so would essentially be kind of at their own discretion and create a constitutional crisis. In terms of constitutional or legal restraints on the president, there are none. So whatever restraints might be applied would be, you know, mainly from the kind of realm of countervailing political power, and would involve some sort of alternative form of legitimate power where an official said, no, that's not in the national interest, and so we refuse to take that step. But then at what point, the sort of people further down the chain of command would respond, who they would listen to, that's really anybody's guess.
But you're describing something that's
constitutional limits.
Yeah, that's extra constitutional, what you're describing. I mean,
exactly.
That would be somebody derelict in their duty. In fact, if the president says, I want to launch a nuclear missile on North Korea, he has the absolute authority to do that. Am I correct, Michael?
You're correct.
And the only...
It's worth noting that the United States is the only nation that's ever used nuclear weapons. You know, the idea that you laid out is one that Americans like to imagine where another power is attacking us. But in fact, that's never happened. The only thing that has happened is that the United States has preemptively used nuclear weapons.
I don't want to dwell on that, but that very notion is a little unsettling. If we're generally going to launch a war, you need congressional approval, don't you? I mean, it's funny that we can't go to war against Japan or China or Russia or North Korea unless Congress approves it, and yet the president has the ultimate authority with a nuclear weapon.
Well, that's not actually true. The president could engage in any form of military action against another nation or non-state actor if he sees it as in the nation's interest.
I thought the Congress had the authority to wage war. I thought that was congressional action.
The Constitution does grant Congress the power to declare war. However, it also names the president as commander-in-chief and gives him command of the U.S. Armed Forces. And so in that capacity, he could engage in military action and then go to Congress seeking its approval within 90 days. That's the procedure spelled out in the War Powers Act.
And Oriana, as you study this, how much confidence do you have in the system that we've built here in the United States for the launch of a nuclear weapon?
Well, we have various systems. We have submarine-launched ballistic missiles. We have intercontinental ballistic missiles. And we can also launch nuclear warheads on missiles from bombers, the B-2 and the B-52. So we have aircraft subs and land-based ICBMs. So we have three different systems that make up the nuclear triad, really. And some of them are even being upgraded. We're in the process of upgrading our ICBMs, starting to build new ICBMs, along with some new cruise missiles that will be able to be launched from aircraft. And they are going to be continuously updated for decades to come. And that's kind of the idea that the Air Force has, at least at this moment, to keep these missiles upgraded and perhaps even get some new technologies to expedite and streamline how we employ these weapons should we need to use them.
So how does it work? So rightly or wrongly, the president decides we have to launch a nuclear weapon, you know, preemptively or reacting to a strike against us. He gets intelligence that says, what happens? Do they call him into a room and say, here's what we know, you have to make a decision? Can either of you walk me through that scene a little bit?
Sure. It was kind of going back to what I was saying a little bit earlier. I mean, it would assemble, depending on where the president was, he would be assembled with his advisors, which includes his national security advisor, with those from Strategic Command on the telephone, along with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They would assemble and they would discuss how to best proceed, again, if it was preemptive or if they were to take the first leg of that. And after the advisors go through all of the pros and cons of the situation, with the Joint Chiefs standing by, given that they might also have to deploy their forces, would they need to be ready or to retaliate after the nuclear strike is over, what's the best way to go forward? And that, again, would just trickle down all the way to the men and women sitting in ICBM silos out west, should it be a land-based ICBM going forward?
Okay.
Or if there are assets in the area like subs or aircraft that could do it.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm interested in the trickle-down, because say the president's made the decision and he's in Washington, D.C., and those advisors are in the room with him, or maybe some of them are on a teleconference or something like that. Somebody has to make a phone call to somebody, and my understanding is that there's a laminated card that the president has with some sort of code on it, literally, mm-hmm. and that has to be read one person to another. Michael, do you understand that to be the case, too?
Yes, that's correct. These procedures were developed over time, but most of what today constitutes command and control, which you just described, was developed in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. That was right as intercontinental ballistic missiles were being perfected as a weapon. Kissinger and Kennedy had this sort of standoff over missiles being based in Cuba, as you may recall, in 1962.
Sure.
And in that moment, Kennedy was very concerned about the possibility that nuclear war would break out based on somebody having essentially an itchy trigger finger, and wanted to ensure that he would have exclusive control over ordering nuclear strikes. At that point, they intensified the controls over the nuclear arsenal, and the advent of what's known as the nuclear football came into being, which allowed the president to have on his person at all times these codes, including the laminated card that you've described, which allow him to authenticate that he is president and he is ordering a nuclear strike.
But that sounds old school to me. I mean, so there he is on a phone going, okay, the code is 0739B2. It's like he's reading the serial number on the back of his transponder on his cable box or something. And then somebody on the other end goes 0739523. I have the same laminated card here. The only two people on earth that have these cards are the president of the United States and his staff with that football, and me and somewhere in the chain of command on the way to the silos. So that's a sort of fail-safe. I guess it ensures that nobody can grab the phone or pretend to be the president and call in a strike. They have to have had that code. So
Correct. And there is an old-school element to it. But one thing I would emphasize is that, and we see this, too, with election security, is that oftentimes it's easier to hack and impersonate and sort of fabricate information in a digital space than in this sort of more old-school manner. One of the kinds of ways that our elections are somewhat safe from such hacking is that they are old school, right?
Yeah, right.
Actual pen and paper, and so that does provide a certain level of security.
To be honest with you, it's interesting you make that point. I mean, if you said, okay, what makes you feel more comfortable that it's done by an encrypted electronic password and somebody just keys in something on a computer, laptop. I don't like that at all. Those people have my target card right now. I'm not comfortable with that. So maybe it's better that it's some physical piece of paper in a suitcase and that guy standing next to the president and nowhere else, right? Maybe that's
arguably almost
better. Although my understanding is...
I understand that further down the chain of command, there are, of course, codes that are punched into computers. So it's not exclusively a pen and paper operation.
Well, then, is there not also a point where keys are turned and that at least two keys have to be turned simultaneously? Can either... Oriana, talk a little bit about that.
So going back to the land-based ICBMs, yes, it is also very old school down there. If you ever get the chance to tour one of those, it's floppy disks, it's keys needing to be turned. Yes, there's a computer and digital element, but it's also to withstand such hacking, and that's why it goes back to that old school mentality, and that's exactly why people have to sit down there. It's not something that could just be punched in digitally, remotely from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. It has to be a physical person who's down in that silo who does it, and that's why the men and women are sitting down there.
You know, all these protocols that sort of safeguard the system are mechanical ones. That is, make sure that it's representing the will of the president. Going back to our first point, though, but there's nothing to safeguard the will of the president. I mean, what if the president is crazy or just making a terrible decision, or he's angry or he's petulant, or he's operating with the best information available, but it's the wrong decision?
Yeah.
I'm interested in some other procedure that would compromise swiftness, but would make sure that we don't make the world a much worse place. And we don't, guys, do we have anything along those lines in the pipeline here?
We have go ahead.
I was just going to say this is certainly one argument that is always made in presidential elections, that you have to weigh the stability and the capability of this individual that you may be electing as president to have this kind of power. And certainly that's the argument that Hillary Clinton made throughout the campaign, inferring that Donald Trump was not a person who had the kind of emotional stability to carry out this role, but the voters disagreed with her. And you know, that's really a first in presidential history where this kind of argument has been featured in a campaign and seemingly not had much resonance with voters. It's not the first time it's been raised.
Yeah,
certainly
for sure.
People made this case in the 1964 election against Goldwater. They made this case with reference to Sarah Palin in the 2008 election. But it's the first time when American voters have essentially seemed to be unconvinced by the case that a particular candidate is not fit to wield this power. One other thing I would just note briefly on this score is that one of the near misses in kind of American nuclear history occurred in October of 1973 during the Yom Kippur War. And at that point, Egypt had invaded Israel. There was growing hostility and tension between the United States and the Soviet Union over that fact. This was in the midst of the Watergate crisis when President Nixon was drinking heavily and perhaps not entirely stable mentally. And at that point, his Defense Secretary James Schlesinger informed the Joint Chiefs that they should not act on any nuclear orders that came from the president without consulting him. And rather famously, Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State and National Security Advisor at the time, raised U.S. forces to DEFCON 3 status in the midst of this crisis when President Nixon was allegedly passed out drunk on the night of October 24th, 1973. So there have been instances where presidents perhaps have not been fit enact their constitutional duties in this regard. And it is the real, loophole, if you will, in this elaborate command and control procedures that who controls the president.
Right. And I'd like to add that it's also been debated, and especially in recent weeks, what constitutes an illegal order. It's one of those things where the president does have full authority in this regard. But General Hyten, who's the head of Strategic Command, once again, was talking at the Halifax Forum saying that he would dispute an illegal order. But the question is, what is an illegal order? Would it be necessity, distinction, unnecessary suffering, for example? All of these factors that have to be weighed by the advisor. advisors in the room and also have to be verified and heard from the Secretary of Defense. He has to hear it from the president as they go through all of these bullet points of what could come of it if they were to take the strike.
I saw him make that speech, and I didn't at the time, of course, but I've gone back and looked at it. And he said, it's pretty simple. You know, if the president gives me an illegal order, I won't execute it. If he gives me, and then this is what will happen. He'll say, what is a legal order? And then I'll tell him, and then we'll talk about it, and we'll do the right thing. You know, problem solved. And I thought, not really. I was kind of amazed at that scenario. I thought the Constitution gives the president the authority. He can launch the nukes if he wants. Now, I don't know what would an illegal use of the nuclear weapons be? Unnecessary suffering? It's a nuclear weapon. There's never going to be a there will always be collateral damage if you launch a nuke. People are going to suffer who had, you know, no blame. So I don't know what he's talking about there. Do you, Oriana?
Yeah, it's one of those things where there's a lot of ambiguity that surrounds his speech in general of what illegal really means. But it's not just unnecessary suffering. Of course, there's going to be suffering. It's nuclear war, as many officials have said multiple times from the Pentagon. It's our worst day as a nation. It's not something to be proud of. It's something that would devastate millions of people. So it's just a question of what is illegal classified, but it could pinpoint to what the unnecessary risk of what it would do to U.S. soldiers, sailors, and Marines, as well as the U.S. population. And that's a question that, you know, the end-all, be-all effect of what they would also have to debate and weigh in that advisory meeting.
Yeah, but I mean, but all they can do is come up with their most concerted effort to dissuade the president from doing it. But if the president says, okay, I've taken all that into consideration, launch the missiles, the law says they have to launch the missiles. And if they don't, they're breaking the law. And maybe they'll be heroes, maybe they won't be, but the president has the right to do what he wants to do. It's 2:54. On the phone line is Michael Allen, professor of history at Northwestern, and Oriana Pollack is an airfare reporter at military.com. I have just a minute or so left, guys, but then we imagine, okay, so the keys get turned and the missiles get launched, like they know where to go. Somebody needs to tell them what targets, what country, how many. I wonder how that decision gets made. Michael, do you have any insight on that?
Well, that's also at the president's discretion with the consultation of his advisors. But within the football, there are various launch strategies or launch missions. In other words, a sort of menu of options that the president can choose from that range from a very limited, sort of tactical nuclear strike on a specific point using maybe one warhead mm-hmm. of limited power to, mm-hmm. you know, all-scale, full-blown nuclear war.
So literally somebody pulls him off the green.
Which he thinks is most appropriate.
Yeah, so somebody grabs him and says, oh my God, Mr. President, we're having this, we got to have this conversation now. I've got the football here. They pull out a laminated sheet and they go, here are the options for the North Korea campaign. And which one do you like? Huh? Like a coach on the sidelines of an NFL game. It's third and long. What are we going to do? Here's the three or four plays we've got mapped out in advance, right?
And
the president picks one. So, Oriana, then they program the missiles accordingly and off they go, huh?
The coordinates will be in there, just kind of like coordinates when flying a plane. You have them, you have a place to go, it's going to fly, it's going to have that trajectory. That's if you decide to use the land-based ICBMs. But again, you could have, you know, things in the area such as, like I said earlier, bombers or submarines that also have the capability of doing it. You plug in the coordinates, and if they're in the area, they could also launch. So it just depends on how the president would give that full authority and what he would choose to do, what to use, how it would happen.
Oriana's at military.com. At Northwestern University, a professor of history, Michael Allen. Oriana, it's nice to talk to you again. And Michael, nice to meet you. Thank you both for your expertise today. Let's never talk again, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.